Welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. My name is Mark Williams, and I'm talking to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. My guest today is Mr. Jay Goodgall, the Managing Director of Castalia Partners Limited in New York. Castalia Partners is registered in Guernsey, has managed assets worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Its core competencies include agriculture, commodities, energy, infrastructure, and real assets. In the maritime and transportation space, Castalia has experience in investing in ships, ports, and terminals. Castalia focuses on stable cash flow, consistent gains, and relatively low volatility. The firm has an eye for ESG policy issues and the rule of law. Jay has been with Castalia for 29 years, before which he graduated BA in Social and Behavioral Sciences from the Johns Hopkins University and MBA from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. In 1992, in partnership with Peter Stokes, Jay launched the first shipping hedge fund, Castalia Offshore Partners Limited. And in 1996, COPL launched the first FFA fund, Excalibur Global Investments Limited. So investing in shipping assets, whether they are steel or paper, is something that Jay is completely expert in and hugely experienced. So we're very delighted to have you on the show with us today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Jay, with your sort of investor's hat on, how does a firm with a focus on consistent gains and low volatility approach the shipping industry, which is inherently inconsistent and volatile?
Well, I think you have to look at the rationale for that. Investors, I think now are seeking more stable cash flows because of volatility of markets. I think we have seen that over the course of the last 10 years, and I think we're going to see that over the course of the next 10 years. So that when you're looking at investments, what you're looking at are long-term contracts, long-term relationships, and assets that have a long-term viability and lifespan, as long as you take that approach from an investment standpoint.
So does that mean invest in shipping by all means, but not in the spot market?
Well, if you invest in the spot market, as many people have over the years, you can't consistently or inconsistently shift from the spot market to the period market and back to the spot market expecting consistent rates of return, nor can you expect consistent rates of return in just the spot market. But over time, you know, the spot market has produced an historical average. And if you're comfortable with that capital return, then that is a serious approach to investing. I would prefer going forward to see a longer term consistent rate of return that's stable, in which case it's long term markets and its long-term cash flows.
Yeah. And do you think it's the case that, therefore, an investor looking for value in the shipping markets today with such uncertainty about the regulatory situation should therefore be looking for those long-term relationships? I'm thinking particularly of the kind of deals we see now where mining companies or energy companies encourage ship owners to build LNG dual fuel ships on the back of long-term charter agreements.
Exactly. I think if you look at shipping, it's been cyclical. And I think what you're getting to is an issue that is difficult for ship owners in that decarbonization is not cyclical by any means. There is some minor cyclicality to wanting to do a decarbonization strategy, but over time, the world has to decarbonize. It's produced too much carbon so far, and it has to reduce that carbon output or footprint. And that is a secular trend rather than a secular culture trend. And looking at it from the standpoint how the two businesses, if you can call decarbonization a business, actually operate, the two are not consistent. And so in order for you to invest in shipping with decarbonization over the next 10 years or the next 50 years, being much more of a just a straight trend line, then you're looking at the need for investment to reflect those types of cash flows. I think any investor recognizing that is going to say, I need a long-term consistent returns to match that particular issue, which is increasing in requirements as well as increasing in the overall environment in which we do business.
Because I have a thesis that because the cost of investing in new low carbon technologies is so great, that there's going to be a case for something more like industrial shipping and a smaller spot market in the future, with more ships being produced on the back of long-term charters, so that the shipping market of the future might look a bit more like the LNG shipping market does today, where you have very expensive ships which are part of a long-term multi-decade project, and the ship is fully employed on that project. And rather than something like the tramp shipping market today, where you have a host of independent owners all competing for cargoes, providing a commoditized or commodified service, the price of which is the main determinant of who gets the business or not, which is organized by an intermediary or group of intermediaries in the shipbroking community. That's the spot market model, and that works for independent ship owners. But the cargo interests think, well, we're going to have to control the carbon emissions from our supply chain. Then that means we're going to have greater control over our supply chain, which probably means, doesn't it, more long-term business and less spot market business.
I think you're exactly right. In fact, I think you're 100% correct in that investors will have to look at shipping not as a lottery ticket, but as a business that does produce a consistent rate of return. And for those who are, since you are sensitive to decarbonization, you need to cover the costs of that over a long period of time. And you need to, in effect, those costs are spread out over a long period of time, and your returns cover that on a consistent basis.
Yeah. So, you know, the low carbon shipping universe might be one in which investors team up with ship operators, maybe with lessors in the middle. Maybe the independent ship owners of today become the sort of independent ship operators of the future, who are working as part of a team with the fiduciary owners of the ships, which might be a lessor, might be a bank, you know, it might not be the independent ship owner, to provide a service to a cargo interest, which meets not only, you know, X thousand or X million tons a year of cargo deliveries, but also meets certain emission standards throughout the lifetime of that contract. So really then you're looking at, as you say, the stable returns rather than playing the asset cycle with these ships.
Yes, I think you're actually describing a blockchain in that, you know, the problem is decarbonization. You start with measurement and process of the chain and how every part is brought into the process that ends with the delivery of a product. And how does one actually measure and monitor all of that process is by something of a blockchain approach to the problem. Mm-hmm. It's going to take time for ship owners to be converted. I mean, look, I was a product of the baby boom in the United States, living on carbon and buying high-powered cars that ran fast and spewed lots of CO2. Today, I'm much more sensitive to what the world is going through. And the world has to change because we can't live in a society, in a world that's in being environmentally damaged. So you go from being a dinosaur to being educated and knowledgeable to actually impacting and reducing your carbon footprint. That's a process. Mm-hmm. And the same is hold true with blockchain. Mm-hmm. You're developing these processes and it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, the IMO has set to 2030 to reduce emissions defined amounts, yeah, and by 2050 by defined amounts. But this process is being adapted, and how fast it becomes adapted will be determined by acceptance by not only consumers, but also by investors. And investors have to be willing to look at this as an opportunity to make money rather than an opportunity cost, that one has to try and minimize. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, that process to me looks like a blockchain. I'm not talking about cryptocurrencies in any respect. What I'm talking about is a process and how you measure things and you go about putting things together that produce an overall product and an overall rate of return that's attractive to investors.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have that blockchain, if you have that process, you can sit down as an investor and you can say, okay, I can produce an investment model here. I can produce a plan. I can create a budget. I can start at the end knowing what it is I need to achieve, and I can work backwards from that to see what my risks and my exposures are throughout that whole process.
Yeah, or you could start from the beginning and look at the variables that you're working with and work to the end and figure out numbers. I mean, people have called this part of the understanding of this process an ESG approach, but you have to remember ESG combines a lot of different things to the mm-hmm. process. It's environmental, it has social, and it has governance. To the extent that we all don't believe in slavery anymore, the social aspects of it is really how you treat people along the way. And yeah. that means your employees and the like, and looking to make sure that those employees' health and welfare are not being impugned with pollutants, I'll mm-hmm. say. The greater focus from a ship owner's perspective and tends to be from most regulatory happens to be environmental. But I would argue that government, which is on the other side of the coin of ES and G, is equally demanding, and it's demanding through regulatory. Mm-hmm. And so in order to take advantage of and enhance profitability, one would actually look towards managing a operation, a business that enhances and takes advantage of the regulatory as well as of the environmental regulatory regulations mm-hmm. That are put forth by government. And so when you incorporate and look at decarbonization, because that just deals with the carbon aspects of it, not all greenhouse gas emissions. You have to look back at what policies and procedures are you putting into this blockchain called the policy procedures or ESG, putting into the blockchain to ensure that you are meeting the desired ultimate goals of decarbonization or reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah.
And what that ultimately does is it reduces the number of participants in the marketplace, because there are groups of people that say, I don't want to deal with this because I just don't understand the requirements, which also increases internal rates of return because there's less participants in the game. Mm-hmm. But it also means that you're having higher capital requirements. And to meet the returns of those capital requirements, I would rather see consistent rates of return being produced rather than volatile rates of return from daily charter markets.
Yeah. This governance thing, I think, is going to get bigger, isn't it? I mean, there are ESG scorecards that investors can look at now. So our friends at Weber, for instance, produce a shipping ESG scorecard so you can rate listed companies. But the governance thing is really about transparency, isn't it? It's, you know, shipping is an offshore business. It's just been exempted from the global, or the global 139 countries, I think, have agreed to have a floor of corporation tax rates. And shipping has specifically been exempted, but I think that the definition of shipping has been quite weak. You know, does that apply to ship owners or terminal operators or ship operators or charterers? You know, to whom does that apply? And I think that that's probably going to come back and apply to shipping in a way that might reduce the advantages of being registered through international registries, flags of convenience, as they're sometimes known, as having those offshore tax-efficient registrations.
Well, I think the one thing that will ensure this steady trend in decarbonization are the banks, because without fund, there's no space rocket, there's no Buck mm-hmm. Rogers. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, there's no ship owners without funding. this industry requires funding. So if you have financial institutions that are committed and have been committed to decarbonization, you have the basis of this cyclical, as we originally started, the cyclical industry, which tends to try and get around things as much as possible, being forced into this box of this trend line that's moving in one direction. And because the financial markets are so integrated, it's only going to be ultimately a limited number of financial institutions that are going to be able to say, we don't care about decarbonization. Mm-hmm. That fully in place, and it's not fully in place yet, but it's going in that direction. You'll have the ship owner either say, I want to continue trying to do the business I was doing 20 years ago and just using really dirty bunkers that produce a lot of pollutants, or I'm going to change the way I do business and producing the power on the ships through dual fuels or other methods, even wind. And yeah, you're seeing that happen right now.
Yeah, sure. The technology is moving ahead. But yeah, I like what you say, you know, talking about the banks, you know, there's a limited number of banks that are going to not care about decarbonization. I think the flip side of that surely is that there's going to be a limited number of ship owners or a limited kind of ship owner who's going to be able to access funding. You know, this is decarbonization, I fear, may drive corporatization of the shipping industry as the regulatory barriers or the technological barriers to entry increase.
But you've been having that for years. I mean, look at the size of Costco. Look at the size and how concentrated the container market is. Just the nature of how energy is being produced over the next 20 to 30 years. And you will find an approach that is significantly decarbonized. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have had onshore and offshore wind turbines, and the UK is probably in the lead in that on the offshore side, because I think it's headed towards 30% of its energy being wind turbine.
Yeah, we're the world leaders in the UK.
If I'm correct.
Offshore wind. Yeah, absolutely. And it's globally, I think it's a huge opportunity for the shipping industry, because there aren't anything like enough offshore installation and maintenance vessels around. And they themselves are going to have to be decarbonized as well. They're going to have to run on zero carbon fuels or be able to generate their own power somehow to be able to stay on station for as long as they, you know, if they were to do that burning fuel oil or exactly. Diesel, it would make a mockery.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. Sorry to interrupt, but they're going to require dual fuels. They're going to be needed for the building of such, because the building is just continuing to increase. But you have to also recognize that governments themselves want to not only monitor the process, but move the process along at a certain rate. And there's a reason for that. Let's just take China, for instance. China wants to move at a certain rate that doesn't cause suddenly the entire mining industry of China to be eliminated and suddenly lots of people who are unemployed. Mm-hmm. I have always argued, since the time I started in this industry, that shipyards are socioeconomic engineering companies. They are not capitalist types of entities. And one might suddenly raise their hands and say, how dare you, Jay? But if you look at shipyards, in good times, the government comes to the shipyard and says, oh, you can add a couple hundred people for employment. Mm-hmm. And in bad times, the shipyard suddenly sees the government come in and say, we'll subsidize you and you'll put an extra 100 people on employment because we need more people employed in bad times. So they're not really capitalistic enterprises. They're a function of governments needing to manage employment. Yep. And that's socioeconomic. So that what you're looking at here in 2021 is governments like China saying, how do I manage the process of decarbonization that doesn't just suddenly coal miners out of work because of the fact that if they do, they're going to, coal miners have dynamite, they have picks, they have axes and chisels that go chisel for the coal. They have, I'm using old terminology now, but effectively, as a politician, you don't want to see someone with an axe that can break coal mm-hmm. and come into your office with that axe and say, you know, you cost me my job. And he's axed, rather the politician's axed, literally rather than figuratively. I'm saying this in a colloquial way, but you have to understand that governments are seeking to manage the process of decarbonization. And that will entail a time frame at which things occur. If we go through a down period in the global economy, you're going to see both increased pressure on decarbonizing, but also reduction in pressure from governments that are seeking to make sure that people are keep employment even in areas of business that are producing pollutants.
Yeah, taking your point about what happens in the next downturn, you know, if you have a situation where, for instance, inflation is back and the Federal Reserve may have to start increasing interest rates, it's not thinking about it yet, but it's thinking about it, then the cost of borrowing in dollars is going to go up for a lot of the emerging markets where most of this investment in decarbonization is going to have to happen. So, you know, if you have a slowdown in the global economy combined with the return of inflation and higher interest rates, what's that going to do to the amount of money that's available for investing in low carbon projects like zero carbon fuels for shipping?
Well, for foreign people who borrow in U.S. dollars, it may not impact as much as you think, because the inflation aspect of it will reduce. It encourages you to borrow in dollars because you pay back in cheaper dollars because there's higher inflation. So the currency will go down. So there's offsets for people who borrow in U.S. dollars. What I look at is in times of difficult economic environments, that's when you really want to make capital investments in technology that reduce overall costs. And decarbonization is, in effect, partly that. It's people investing in technology ultimately to reduce costs.
Yeah.
And if you have your cost structure over time being pretty consistent and you have your revenue stream over time defined, you're much better protected from an investment standpoint by having long-term contracts.
Yep. Coming back to that. Absolutely.
I think the world will go my way versus the way there will be an investor group that focuses on volatility. But I would rather be in the camp of not focusing on earnings volatility.
Yeah. Talking of camps, we have a new camp in Washington now. You know, we're 6 months into the Biden administration, and they've been putting the environment at the center of their economic policy, of their trade policy, of their foreign policy. How do you rate the efforts of the Biden administration from an investment perspective? Do you think that it's supporting investment in zero carbon technologies? Do you think it's allowing space for shipping to go to the investment community, the huge investment community in the US, and say, you know, we need to do this, please give us funds? Is it supportive?
Well, where we've come from, it's like night and day. I mean, we came from an administration where our president thought that wind turbines create cancer. Today, we have a more, what I'll call more rational administration that is looking to, one, rebuild our infrastructure, but also look at the problem and say, we need to be focused on greenhouse gas emissions and look towards an environment that is better than what we have now. And to do so, we need technology. Mm-hmm. Technology is what is going to produce that. And so they are focused on it. Whether we get a period of time, because our governments can change over on a four-year basis, particularly the federal administration, will be seen.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be good to have a consistency of that. And I think the one thing they're trying to do is throw so much money at the problem that you can't, the next administration, if it were a different party and a different approach, could not stop the process.
Yep.
Yeah. In school, government is not, where I graduated, it's not called government studies. It was called political economy. And that's because politics is involved in the economy.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how much the countries like China, when they decide, you know, President Xi says they're going to decarbonize by 2060. And yes, he has to take into account extremely powerful coal mining lobby in China and also in the CCP. But the, China has the ability, in the same way that it's dragged 500 million people out of poverty in a generation, it has the ability to make those grand changes because it can take a multi-decade view, which is rather harder to do in the Western liberal democracies where the political cycle is only 4 or 5 years and you can chop and change between parties which have very different views of how to achieve environmental goals or whether or not we should even have environmental goals.
You're correct in that standpoint. I wouldn't argue against that issue in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
I think the problem for China is different than the problem for the United States. I mean, China is more sensitive to let's take an example, those coal miners. I mean, when you had Hillary Clinton in 2016 call for, you know, a changeover from coal and just effectively wiping out the coal industry, even though there were only 75,000 coal miners in the United States left anymore. That scared the living hell out of people as types of action she was interested in taking. Not that I think she was wrong, because I don't think she was able to convey that you will re-educate you and enable you to be participatory, say, in the onshore or offshore wind market, where I think today there are about 275,000 to 300,000 employees. 20, 30 years ago, you would have said, I wouldn't have expected that in terms of number of employees in different markets. Today, I expect there to be less coal miners and there to be more employees in the on and offshore wind markets, just even in the servicing of it, let alone the building the equipment, so that China can do things that we can't do politically. But I wouldn't argue for a political system like China.
Wouldn't expect you to. No.
It works for them. I mean,
yeah, well, it certainly works for the ones at the top. You know, we've had 100 years of the Communist Party just celebrated this week, and President Xi is being, China is increasingly assertive. And the Chinese version of history is that history is cyclical and that the job of the government is to try and hold off the periods of anarchy for as long as possible and to maintain the periods of harmony and social order for as long as possible. They have a different view of history, for instance, you might say, to the American view of history, which is one of continuous improvement.
Yeah, I was in China in 97 and in China subsequently in about 12 and 2015 or so, 16. And I think maybe in 06, 07, I can't remember. But the managing a 1.5 billion people is rather different. And in the United States, where we have 330 million to 350 million, with having had the experience of live free or die type of quotes on flags, it's even more difficult to manage that type of population size. The rule of law, the rule of large numbers suggests that things can go wrong when you get numbers that big.
Yeah.
And that's the problem in managing a society, of whether it's 300 plus million or whether it's a billion and a half.
Yeah. There's a lot of individual choices there, aren't there? And if you're going to try and impose some of those choices by saying, look, the environment is a hard stop, you know, either we prevent the planet from overheating or the lifestyle that we've all become used to ends, then it's very difficult for government, certainly in a political cycle like we have in the West, to try to instill that long-term thinking in a short-term political cycle. And even in the Chinese system, where supposedly you have a new president every 8 years, it's hard to do it there.
Well, just think of it, in our lifetime, one would never have expected to see ships go across the Arctic year-round.
Quite so.
And if that isn't telling people to decarbonize over time, you have a problem. You have a choice of decarbonizing or becoming the fossil yourself. So I'd rather decarbonize while I'm here and help my daughter and her offspring, you know, live a healthier lifestyle than what we've created.
Yeah. I think it comes down to that for everybody, doesn't it? You know, ship owners are citizens too. And every ship owner I speak to says, yes, of course, we want to decarbonize. But, you know, there's also the issue of commercial sustainability. We've got to be able to stay in business. We need it. This is my livelihood.
Well, there's no obligation once you're in the shipping industry of remaining in the shipping industry. It's, you know, people need to look at things and say, hey, look, how can I make a profit in the industry? Of course. But how do I make a profit in a world that's going to be different than what we grew up in?
Yeah.
And what we grew up in was a carbon-based society, and now we're looking towards making technology work properly to decarbonize.
Yeah, making technology work properly to be able to talk when we're doing these podcasts would be good for our viewers' benefit. Yes. For our listeners' benefit, we've had three or four goes at getting this podcast going today. So, Jay, I've taken up an inexcusable amount of
time. I'm losing power right now because I'm on battery, so I'm going to have to cancel out. But it's been great, and I thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time to come on. Appreciate your patience while we got this set up. It's always good to speak to you, Jay. And thank you so much for sharing the benefit of your experience and insights with us.
Great. It's been fun.
Okay. We'll speak again soon.
Talk with you soon.
Thanks very much. And thank you to all our listeners out there in podcast land. This is Mark Williams signing off from the Ship.Energy podcast. And we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.